Good evening. You are listening to The Talking Show on K-Chung Radio, Chinatown's only micro-broadcasting radio station. I am Nicholas Miller, here as always with the, well, fatigable.
Pretty fatigued. Pretty fatigued today.
Rarely fatigued, yeah. But today fatigued, Steve Kiddo. Can you tell the good listeners why you're fatigued, Steve?
Oh, I just flew in from Austin. It's our my first time doing this commute back for the talking show from Austin.
Yeah, don't worry. This is covered in our contract.
Yeah.
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 That's not going to be a problem.
But having not done it yet. Also, just like moving is stressful and hard work, and so I'm pretty exhausted from that. And then the flight's not that bad.
No. Did you watch anything good on the flight?
I saw Alita: Battle Angel.
Which
turns out is a Richard Rodriguez movie.
Oh, okay.
And was made entirely in Austin.
Yeah.
It's a sci-fi movie adapted from a manga that is about a female cyborg discovered in a junk pile who, it turns out, is a rare form of military technology made by Mars colonists to attack the decadent people who live in sky cities.
Oh, okay. They live in sky cities because the surface of the Earth has been destroyed or something.
Or it's
like
a class war thing, like the poor people live on the surface.
I see.
Yeah.
I see. I flew to Texas recently too, and I watched a Liam Neeson movie.
Oh.
Which I feel like is all you need to say these days. Like the whole plot
the
just kind of
unfolds.
Right? Yeah.
It's like always Taken, but some other form of Taken.
So this one begins where he is, he's always a good guy. He's a good dad.
Yeah.
Even though usually there's some kind of divorce in play or something.
Yeah,
like
he's
that.
Like not that good a dad.
But it's like one of those
good dad, bad husband.
Divorce gets depicted as just like an amicable break or something like that.
Uh-huh.
But he's on the first scene of the film. He's receiving he's like the man of the town award.
Uh-huh.
He has some town up near Canada called
Vermont Springs, Vermont or something.
No, or like vaguely a native language word.
Oh, Okanagashagawa or something.
Yeah, so he's receiving the Oshonohoni award or something like that. For plowing the road. He plows the highway every day.
Oh, I see.
Meanwhile, his son works at the private airport and is captured by gangsters and shot full of heroin and killed.
Oh no.
And so then he goes renegade.
Uh-huh.
Because the police tell him, well, it's just your fault. You're a bad dad. You didn't realize your son was into heroin.
Right.
Really?
It's called like White or something like that. Was that the name of the movie?
It's called like Cold Place or something
Oh, wow. Yeah. All right. Yeah.
But the thing that drew me into the film, other than Liam Neeson, is that it's all set in Denver. Like Denver is the place where the mafia lives, like the drug dealers. So like just, it's really disjunct, like the house you normally live in is clearly in LA.
Yeah.
But then all the like city shots are in Denver and like the establishing shots and whatnot.
Gangster says there's a palm tree in front of it, but then it's in Denver. Yeah.
Yeah. Also the gangster is kind of like, looks like a guy who went to like a Ivy League school.
Right.
Like his scenes, he's like, disciplining his son and taking him to private elementary school.
Uh huh.
So, mixture of like, Mexico City cartel figure.
But from Denver.
Yeah, in Denver. Of course, his enforcer is like a tattooed guy named Squid or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Slime, take care of this bullshit. Take care of him.
Yeah. I'm going back to reading my de Tocqueville.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Fuck. Yeah. What's new with you? How are you doing?
I'm pretty good. Just settling into postgraduate life here in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
I was in the group exhibition that you went to.
Yeah.
So I took that down. And I saw my family. Those felt like the final hurdles relating to school.
Right.
Because seeing my family in Texas was, we had a celebratory dinner about.
Oh, good.
That whole thing. Yeah.
Oh, that's nice of them.
Yeah, it was good. My dad brought up some controversial subjects with the crew.
Oh, natural.
Yeah, which didn't go so well, but...
sure.
Otherwise, it was delightful. I got to have flank steak.
Oh, great.
One of my favorite things.
Yeah.
Which I only realized later in life.
It's a cheaper cut,
though,
right?
Yeah, it's like the cheapest cut.
Yeah, it's not like the most prized
no.
slice.
No, but as a kid, it was always my favorite. I think because it's usually heavily marinated.
Yeah, and very thinly sliced usually, thinly too, sliced, which exactly. makes it easy to eat.
Yeah, in New York, they call it a hanger steak. I think in L.A., too.
Yeah, I used to really enjoy flank steak as well.
Yeah, that's my favorite.
Well, that's
it's kind of chewy.
Well, you know, good in the sandwich.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We went to, and then one of the nights I was there, my parents took us to like a proper steak place, which, you know, in Texas is just called dinner.
Yeah, right.
And it's one of these places, they have these here in L.A. too, where you order everything a la carte. It just seems criminal.
Like you have to get beans, you have to get...
Yeah, and somehow that makes every item more expensive.
Yeah.
Where it's like the steak is $65. You're like, well, that better come with salad or
mashed
something.
Mashed potatoes.
Yeah, and they're like, no, you can order those on the side. Those are $12.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like Pacific Dining Car.
Yeah, what's up with that? Is that like some... It's not French, is it?
No, I have no idea. I think it's just like what a steakhouse is like.
Yeah.
That's like the way it works. That's the way steakhouses operate.
It's criminal. It's kind of like, hey, you know where usually the chef designs the plate for you? Well, why don't you do that and pay more?
See, that sounds like that's very not French.
Yeah, exactly.
That's definitely America.
But it comes from
you
a
know
time.
Better.
It comes from but the a la carte thing is certainly French, and it comes
it's
from
a French
time.
Word.
Sure. So at some point there was an attempt to infuse it with Frenchiness.
I mean, to make it seem fancy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of Frenchiness, we have
the Frenchiest,
the Frenchiest of all the intellectuals on today's stage.
Yeah.
We'll admit we've had our guest before on the show, but
it's not always a good. It's not really a good idea to have our guest ever. And some might argue as well.
True.
Yeah,
but
controversial.
We were looking around at the rest of the talking field and realizing that we're one of the only long-standing talking institutions that doesn't have this person over at least every other year or something.
Yeah.
So we figured it was high time.
Yeah.
To invite him back on. So a man who needs no introduction.
Mm-mm.
Slavoj Žižek.
No. The titles I like, but not because I'm lazy, but precisely because I'm a workaholic, are pseudo titles, you know, that they give the impression that they mean something, but basically they mean nothing. They give you full freedom. Like when I got that big prize 15 years ago at Kulturwissenschaftliche Institut in Essen for a project that I ran there, I gave the title Antinomies of Postmodern Reason, which means strictly nothing, you know. Like it can be about South African agriculture. It can be about, I don't know, fishing. Are we killing too many whales or whatever, you know? But again, it's not because I bluff. It's just I don't want to be, you know what? I don't want to be, to have the frame.
Actually, the title's the
frame.
You are dead already, but you wanna stay alive. So just choose
maybe
whatever you want. And
And
you can start your lecture.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. So first, let me also express my gratitude and how honored I feel to be here. And I especially feel at home. This is my old socialist training. Look what's there. Marx Engels' work, you know, from my youth. But to avoid a misunderstanding here with all these jokes about a palace of culture and so on, not only am I not, as some stupid people accuse me, a kind of a secret closet Stalinist or whatever. On the contrary, this is, I think, still the big trauma. I don't think we have a proper theory. What went wrong? In what way? How was something like Stalinism even possible, imaginable? And this is one of the reasons of my eternal tension with some followers of Frankfurter Schule or Habermasians. Look, one great argument against Habermas for me is this one. If you were to read all of Habermas, I doubt if you, let's say all about you knew about Germany in the last 50 years, you would have learned it from reading Habermas's books. Would you even have guessed that there are two Germanies? I don't think. Habermas strictly behaves as if he lives in West Germany. It's an immanent critique and so on. And that's what always, already when I was a student, that's what shocked me about Frankfurter Schule. On the one hand, what is their basic project? Dialektik der Aufklärung, which means, to simplify it, the horrible things that happened in the 20th century, Gulag, Holocaust, and so on, are not simply some regression into pre-modern logic like barbarism returned. No, they were something which was there as an immanent potential of the project of modernity itself. Okay, but then why did they focus in their analysis only almost exclusively on fascism? I mean, it should be done, no doubt here. It intrigued me that isn't Stalinism a much clearer example, case of dialectic der Aufklärung? Because fascism was not Aufklärung. It was, as we all know, a conservative modernization, like this impossible dream, how to have capitalism, without class struggle. For this, you need an external enemy, the Juden, and so on and so on. But, and incidentally, I've written about it. It's so nice in what way you can account for this basic difference, which doesn't make Stalinism any better, between Stalinism and fascism, even at the level of these apparently totally superficial rituals and so on. To give you one example, do you know, I read this in Ann Applebaum's book on Gulag, that even in the harshest times, mid-30s and then till 50, every year on Stalin's birthday, all prisoners in a Gulag camp were gathered and had to sign, each of them, a telegram to Comrade Stalin, wishing him all the best, and so on and so on. Now, of course, I'm not an idiot. I'm not claiming they really meant it. What I'm claiming is this, and here you can see one aspect of the difference. Can you even imagine something like this in Nazi Germany? It would have been totally meaningless in the Nazi universe, I don't know, to gather once a year all Auschwitz inmates and make them sign a telegram all wishing all the best to Hitler and so on. Another thing which makes accounts for this difference, precisely this so-called show trials, monstrous trials. You have something which is specific to Stalinism there, this public confession. You know how it looks, like Bukharin and all of them. You were, let's forget in what way. It wasn't even primarily physical torture. It was more pressure, like, if you don't confess, we arrest also your children, whatever. Okay, but the mystery is why the need for this public confession? And you discover something very strange, how, although the one who was at these show trials condemned and so on and confessed, although he was treated as the lowest of the lowest, you know, it's very interesting to read sacred texts of Stalinism, like a short history of Communist Party, the sacred text, with regard to expressions they use, like it's piece of shit, vermin, insect, and so on. So at the same time, you are the lowest of the lowest, but at the same time, it is as if you still participate in universal human mind, that you can account for yourself. For example, I remember reading in the Czech trial, Slansky, I think it was, no? Rudolf Slansky. How, at the beginning, the prosecutor asked him, how did you become a traitor? And he says, I come from a bourgeois family. Already when I was a young boy, my parents taught me to hate workers and so on and so on. What's so interesting is that you see, you are shit, scum of scum. But at the same time, you participate in universal reason and can tell the truth about yourself. This is unimaginable in Nazism. That's why, not because they were better. You cannot, it would have been the easiest thing in the world for the Nazis to organize a big trial where, through torture and so on, they would have made some Jewish leaders, whatever, to confess the plot against Germany. It never happened. It's a my point is that precisely in these perverse details, every prisoner still sending a telegram to Stalin or this confession, this is what makes Stalinism part of Enlightenment movement, that we all participate in it. And again, this is what shocked me. Why don't you find a theory of it in Frankfurter Schule? Now, I did my homework. I know you have Herbert Marcuse, Soviet Marxism, but this is, I read it decades ago, but this is just a very specific analysis of Khrushchev, his speech on the 20th Congress. It's not more. Then you have a couple of texts here, there, but no systematic approach to it. And I'm not accusing them, Frankfurter Schule, of being secretly communist. No, they were quite normal anti-communists, believe me. I read in this big biography of Adorno that, for example, in the early 50s, Horkheimer was so anti-communist that he even thought that social democrats shouldn't be allowed to take power. Social democrat in West Germany. So he was much closer to that first generation Theodor Heuss and so on, liberal politicians. No? So you see, here I think that's why I'm so practically obsessed by Stalinism. Why there is I'm not a right-wing revisionist, definitely not. I'm not playing the game, which is a very dangerous game going on today, of subtly rehabilitating fascism. You know how? The first, in my country also, Slovenia, it's happening. The first step is to say all sides were doing horrible things, to just apparently equalize them. No? Like, you know, this is an old story, like, okay, Germans did horrible things, but Western allies bombed Dresden and so on, all that. Then you go a step further, and you say, very interesting, that you follow this, who is the historian? Nolte, no? Yeah, who wrote a book on Heidegger also. Then you say that, nonetheless, fascism was a reaction to communism, that it took all bad features from communism, like already in Soviet Union before Hitler, they had concentration camps and so on and so on. Then you just have to go one step further and say those who collaborated with the Nazis, they were just confronted with a desperate choice. And they have tragically chosen the lesser of two evils. And in a way, we should understand them, maybe even support them, and so on and so on. And I think this is a very tragic tendency. Not that I have, again, any sympathy for Stalinism, but still I think, not that I think Stalinism was better. You notice for me one argument for Stalinism, that it had dissidents. Dissidents also in the sense of inner party dissidents. Stalin all the time had to fight from Trotsky to others who reproached him for you betrayed the true greatness of communist project and so on and so on. In Nazism, you don't find this. Okay, we can play the game if Georg Strasser or those early SA Nazis were this. But afterwards, once Hitler established himself, sorry, I'm not aware of any tendency in Nazi Germany reproaching Hitler for betraying the true fascist legacy or whatever. And I think precisely this radical inner tension in Stalinism is a perverted effect of the fact that there was an authentic core at the beginning. I think that whatever you say, and we can play this game, I'm ready to play it. I'm not a crazy Trotskyist who claims, oh, if you know this Trotsky's dream. If only Lenin were to survive 3-4 years more and made a pact with Trotsky, there would be no Stalin, we would have what? A kind of a happy social democracy or what? No, I think the tragedy was authentic. I really don't think there was a possibility of another way to be taken. But nonetheless, it was an authentic tragedy in the sense of it did begin as an incredible emancipatory explosion. It turned into a nightmare. And I don't think we have yet a good theory about it. Either we go too far into blaming, I don't know, entire history of humanity. Like, are we aware? That's why I like it. How crazy is Dialectic der Aufklärung, the book? It traces manipulative reason, so-called instrumentelle Vernunft, which culminates in 20th century horrors. It traces it basically to the very beginning of humanity, the first magic thinking, which is already manipulation. So basically the thesis there is that Stalinism, in an ironic sense, is the peak, the climax of the entire history of humanity, you know, in the sense of what began with the first magic primitive so-called manipulations, it culminated in Stalinism. So this, for me, doesn't do the work. I don't believe in this. At the same time, I don't believe in this simple delimitations, but you know what? I'm now getting caught into my own trap of two, three times it did happen to me that I gave a talk and all of the talk consisted of preliminary improvisations, you know.
But actually, so let me only tell you that two things. One is that actually it was also Stalin himself who supposed to send letters to himself, as he was also like differently than Hitler was putting his hands together after his own speeches.
Yeah, I remember. This is one of my big jokes, and you can check it empirically if you don't believe me, that Hitler gives a speech, people applaud, he just stands and recognizes himself as the addressee. When you have a Stalinist leadership, after a Stalin speech, people applaud. Always the leader joins the applause. It may appear nonsense, like, does he applaud himself? No, because the logic is totally different. Stalin's position is not symbolically that of a leader, but that of a perfect servant of the people. That's the basic dogma of Stalinism. We are just instruments of historical necessity or whatever, and so on and so on.
But actually, you have the theories or the explanations tracing the emergence of totalitarianism in Enlightenment, but in the Marxist revisionist behind the Iron Curtain. Kołakowski's book, the first volume of Main Currents of Marxism, is exactly about this. But actually, you have many other, like Popper is also the same. Like,
yeah, but okay, for reasons into which we cannot go now.
The reason is probably because they are coming from Enlightenment tradition differently than the Frankfurter Schule.
Yes, but what I don't, for example, let's take Popper. You know, I for reasons we don't have time now. I'm afraid it will really be just then some introductory remarks exchange between the two of us. You know, for me, I radically disagree with Popper's basic anti-Platonic premise that, you know, Plato. Yes, there are, of course, ominous things in Plato, but my God, if I were to choose between Plato and Aristotle, Plato, absolutely. First, let's not forget this. First, of course, I hope this is a rhetorical question. Did you read Plato's Politeia or what? Republic, whatever you translate it, state. Did you notice two things there, which are extremely important? A, there are no slaves there. Plato's vision excludes slaves. While the good liberal Aristotle, you know, his definition, slaves are talking tools or whatever and so on. Second thing, maybe even more important, I'm sorry to inform you this, but Plato explicitly says, in my ideal state, women are equal to men. All posts are accessible to women also. He explicitly says the fact that women today are not in that position, its historical contingency should be abolished. While Aristotle, on the contrary, he naturalizes, ontologizes even sexual difference, you know, basically male versus female is forum versus morphe versus hyle, forum versus matter, and so on and so on. So, no, I think that, you know, when we accuse some past thinkers of proto-totalitarianism, we should be very, very careful. The same for Robespierre and company, Jacobins. My God, I mean, one thing, there is one reason for which I will forever love them. Their relationship to Haiti Revolution. You know, Haiti Revolution was something for me, one of the greatest events in the history of humanity. Why? Because till then, you know, black slaves rebelled in Haiti around the time of French Revolution. Till that point, all slave rebellions were, let's return home, back to our roots, to whatever, no? And this ruling ideology easily finds it. You remember, if you are old enough, I am unfortunately, and some 30, 40 years ago, there was a Hollywood hit miniseries, precisely The Roots, of how an American black guy finally succeed in retracing to the beginning, so on. The shock of Haiti Revolution was that black slaves rebelled there, but not on this program, returning to our roots, but we want to do the same as French are doing, French Revolution. And here, not that I'm flattering to you, this is one of the most glorious moments for me of Polish history. Because first, all glory goes here to Jacobins. When Haiti delegation, they won first, visited Paris, Assemblée Nationale, they got a triumphant reception in Assemblée Nationale, immediately recognized as equals and so on. Then Napoleon took over, and not only he sent the army to Haiti to crush the rebellion, but he even wrote that this precedent is so dangerous, blacks liberated, that all should be killed, women, children, and new slaves brought there. And he sent there the army where a strong contingent was of Polish soldiers. And I must tell you, I hope you know it, it's one of the most beautiful stories that I know. French army was approaching the black army of liberated slaves. And they heard some singing. They thought, oh, some stupid tribal songs probably. When they come closer, they heard what the black slaves were singing. La Marseillaise, of course, and all the glory to Poles.
But the most cynical in this Napoleon's move was that he sent not just soldiers, but the Polish uprisers against partition. So the people who actually were fighting for freedom and they...
Yeah, the way but that's the beauty. Raised. You know what they did then? The Polish regiment. They simply, I simplify the story, realized, my God, we are fighting on the wrong side. And they... change sides. This is why, even when there was the darkest temptation around 1804-5 to kill the white people, just Black Republic, they always exempted the Poles. And I love this as a nonsensical manipulation, but which works so nicely. You know, in Haiti Constitution 1804, they wanted to have a Black Republic, but they, at the same time, wanted to recognize the Poles. So you know what the Article 4, I think, of this constitution, you know what it says? It says, Haiti is a black republic. All citizens of Haiti, independently of the color of their skin, are black. I think this is an absolutely ingenious solution. No, but you see what I'm saying, to go back to the point. Yes. Horrible things did happen in French Revolution, although, you know, for me it's all a matter of statistics, in the sense of, like, read any precise history, and you will see that there were much more liquidations, killings by state before Jacobins and after in the Thermidor. That it's very simple. Jacobins didn't just kill ordinary poor people, you know. They dared also to kill some notable people, you know. It's like my friend, the Indian writer Arundhati Roy, you know. She wrote to me, you remember 2 years, no, yeah, 2-3 years ago, there were some public rapes in India. And we were all protesting, like 5 people raped a girl in a bus. I agree, to avoid them, it's horrible. But she wrote me, you know why this exploded so widely as news? Because the girl was, in both cases, there were 2-3 cases, middle class and the rapists were poor. She wrote to me, if you want to see horror, go to Bombay, or as you say now, politically correct, go to Mumbai and visit brothels there. You discover absolute nightmares. These middlemen are buying from Nepal and poor parts of India, girls from the age 4 and 5, and simply then you can have her, buy her relatively cheaply as a sex slave permanently. Or I mean, it's nightmare, and it's not a secret. Everybody knows where this happens. You see, nobody writes about this. And we are talking about thousands of cases like this. Here I am returning to my old-fashioned paranoiac attitude of our freedom is bourgeois freedom and so on. Yes, we are free, but to what extent? What do we learn in our media? For example, back to India. You read so little bit about this in our media. You know that now in India, there is a big Maoist rebellion, so-called Naxalite, going on. Probably around 800,000, maybe 1 million rebels fighting for their survival in the jungle, those poor tribal areas, army is now decimating them to develop mining there and so on. But it's not, like, it's incredibly worse than all the top hits of our news, West Bank, Palestine and so on. No, India is supposed to be the biggest democracy good, so you don't mention this. Did you see the movie, which is a shitty movie, I admit, but it has a moment of truth. Did you see Slumdog Millionaire? You remember what happens there at the very beginning? The guy who is just accused of cheating a little bit at some TV quiz is taken to a police station and they're tortured with electricity and so on. And I asked my Indian friends, is this happening? Yes, they told me. If you are not very rich, police is simply torturing people there. And I was told, this is a wonderful detail, that some Indian democratic intellectuals even organized a protest, a petition, wonderfully ironic petition, where they claimed, they demanded from the police to at least raise at the level of Chinese police in Tibet. Because they are torturing there in Tibet, but not if you cheat at the TV quiz, you know. There you are tortured, of course, we know when, if there is a suspicion of contacts with Dalai Lama political, no? So their demand was, please, just follow the Chinese there. Torture us only if there is a political suspicion or what. Don't torture everybody and so on. So how much do we know, but I'm losing time. Short after this short introduction, we have, oh my God, we have, no, okay, I will try to, can we go a little bit over, like it's not that after 40 minutes I have to stop.
Go with your flow.
I hope, okay, sorry? Yeah, but you know that I always fight this metaphysical notion of linear time. This is how I concretely fight it. No, okay, sorry. Now, what I wanted to do, let me do some serious theory at least, is my starting, now I will more report on what I wanted to do. My starting point was the 3 levels of what we confront as problems today. and how they are structured. On the one hand, it is the absolute external enemy. ISIS, Islamic State, Boko Haram, this totally brutal, irrational other. Then we have the mid-level, let's call it new geopolitical tensions, United States, China, or Putin, Russia, and so on. And then we have the renewed, a little bit more radical left in our Europe itself, Syriza, maybe Podemos, and so on and so on. My point, of course, is that the most dangerous is the last one, Syriza, and so on. That ISIS is, it's even so non-transparent to know. I have good connections with Israel, I'm informed. What is going on there? Who is supporting whom? There are some good reasons that Americans and Israelis are not totally innocent there. What is now confirmed, it was published in our press. You just have to look at it. You know, these are the small news. For example, do you know that in South Lebanon, most of the border is controlled by Hezbollah. And then you have one part of the border, eastern part, which is controlled by Al-Qaeda. Because Al-Qaeda is Sunni and fights Hezbollah, Israel is systematically, with arms, food, and medical help, supporting Al-Qaeda there. And it's not a crazy story. It's documented. I mean, they admit it and so on. So who knows what game people are playing there? The reason I find interesting this Islamic fundamentalism is we are not surprised enough of the strangeness of what is going on there. For example, isn't it strange that we have Boko Haram, a big social movement which wants to restructure entire society, and its main programmatic point is women at their own place. That is to say, no Western education for women, which means no education, and so on and so on. Isn't this something so weird? How could this have happened? That all of a sudden we are back to the 60s when we were saying sexuality is political, but not exactly in the same sense, you know. And it's also interesting to what extent it's easy to make fun of Boko Haram, you know. But they are just the extreme point. There is more and more. This is, I think, what is also behind this fear of gay rights, or even, you remember, you were part of it here 2-3 years ago when that crazy Conchita Wurst won Eurovision. The Russian reaction was very interesting. It was almost one step towards Boko Haram reaction, no? Like Putin said, I read in the Bible, there are two kinds of people, men and women. What is going on now here, and so on, you know? My favorite statement was made by Zhirinovsky, the nationalist, who says, in Europe, there are now no longer men and women, there is only it. You know, some kind of Stephen King monster. But still, okay, that's this so-called fundamentalism. What I find strange here are a couple of things. The first thing is that, and here we should become more self-critical. Why is this happening? Why this, also in our country, with fundamentalists, this politicization of religion? Don't blame just Islam. You know that these are official data. FBI in United States has under observation 2 million Americans, Christian fundamentalists, as potential threat. Wait a minute, this is almost the same percentage, 1% too, as in Muslim countries. So, of course, we should fight fundamentalism, but we should also raise the question, what is it in the process of global capitalism which generates fundamentalism? Because fundamentalism is not simply a remainder of the past. You know which example I always quote here? Afghanistan. If some of you are old enough, I am, unfortunately. I remember 40 years ago, 50. Afghanistan was maybe the most secular of the Middle East Islam countries. They had a pro-Western king, kind of a technocrat. They had kind of, they had a very, sorry. They have even a strong local communist party and so on. Then, you know what happened? Communists made coup d'etat. When it failed, Soviet Union intervened to support them. Then Americans mobilized their allies, like Osama bin Laden and so on. So you see what's the tragedy? The most, one of the most tolerant countries, it became fundamentalist as part of being caught in global process. So we shouldn't play innocent here and mock them. There are fundamentalists in Arab countries. There are also fundamentalists in United States themselves. Or which country is probably, apart from ISIS, the most fundamentalist? Saudi Arabia. But are we aware what strange country Saudi Arabia is? It's nothing. It's something that survives strictly from American and other countries' money. It's something which has no substance. They are getting billions from oil. It's Western capitalism or capital organized as a state there. So, again, this would be my first point. Second point, why this politicization? Maybe, did he even visit you here? My Croat friend, Boris Buden. Yeah. He wrote a wonderful book on this phenomena where he developed something with which I deeply agree, that this politicization of religion today that we are witnessing, it's not simply religion invading politics, but literally religion replacing politics itself. It's what we all know is happening. We are approaching an era where our societies are more and more depoliticized in the sense that we have all our private freedoms, but then experts run economy, and all politics that remains is mostly cultural politics. So it's as if politics, which is disappearing, losing its substance, authentic politics, political struggle, is returning in the guise of religion. I think that this politicization of religion is strictly correlative to the disappearance of politics from our societies. Now, okay, I will improvise a little bit, then you cut me short whenever you want. Next thing I would like to develop here is what does this mean? I've written about it, for our notion of freedom. Are we free or not in the West? Maybe some of you know this line of thought of mine, but I would like to repeat it. Of course we are free, and I'm not a stupid Marxist who... I'm not trying to sell you this shit, you know, oh, it's just formal freedom and so on. No, the ABC lesson of Marx is form matters. So an authentic Marxist will never tell you, oh, this is just a formal freedom. Things begin as a form. Look at human rights. We all know that at the beginning, 18th century, human rights were basically rights of white people, of property, and so on. There was a subtle network of exclusions. But instead of saying, okay, these were just formal rights, people did something differently. They simply expanded these rights. First women said, why not also us? Then blacks in Haiti said. So form matters. So, but let me go on. Nonetheless, let's say I ask you, are you free? You would say yes. I also ask myself, I'm not treating you as idiots. Or if I am, I'm also part of a group of idiots. Okay. Then I ask you, in what sense are you free? I claim that most what you would have told me is something like freedom of personal choices, no? You would have told me, I'm free because I can read whatever I want, I can do whatever I want in sexuality, I can travel whatever I want. I can up to a point. Here things get complex. I can say publicly whatever I want. I can take a job, whichever I want. Now, again, I would add if you get it and so on. But okay, this freedom of choices, it's a nice thing, but is this enough? My thesis is, and this is the lesson of what was disclosed by WikiLeaks, and now everyone is talking about it. This is the lesson of this all famous secret, like TISA, secret trade agreements, that we are free, but the social texture frame, which underlies our freedom, which determines what are our choices, is more and more non-transparent. Things are, that's the horror of TISA agreement. Trade and flow of information agreement, which, as we all know, if accepted, will determine in detail coordinates of financial life and other, which will seriously restrain governments of what they can do, and so on. And there was no debate. In the original plan of this agreement, it even said that it should remain secret for 5 years after it is accepted. So this is what fascinated me, how we are free at a personal level, maybe even more and more free. But the very frame of our freedom, you know, you are free in a certain context to choose this or that, that frame is more and more impenetrable. And here ideology enters, I claim. In what sense? Ideology. In the sense that the trick is that your very form of unfreedom is presented to you as a new freedom. You can see this appears in the mode of work, precarious work, which is getting more and more important. It's in a way horrible. You are all the time in anxiety. You, will my contract be prolonged, and so on. You health insurance is not covered. Retirement, you have to do it yourself, and so on and so on. But here come postmodern social theorists like Anthony Giddens, who is now happily half forgotten, who tell you, but these are new forms of freedom. Look, state no longer prescribes to you how to be, what health insurance, you are free to choose it. Or, you know, like, or they say, basically, that the wonderful trick is to treat each of us as a small capitalist, no? The official postmodern theory is this one. We are all self-entrepreneurs. Let's say I'm a poor worker, I get a credit for 10,000 euros. And then I'm free to choose. Will I go take my family to a big holiday? Will I put money aside for studies of my children? Will I invest in health or whatever? It's true. You have this choice. But at the same time, this, the constellation of this choice causes incredible anxiety, effectively limits your freedom, and so on and so on. So I think that, again, this is our paradox. What is more and more disappearing from our societies is freedom, which should be part of our Western freedoms, and not communist, but even ordinary democratic freedoms. The freedom, not just the freedom of choice within the existing social framework, but the freedom to collectively decide how to change this framework itself. And this is, I claim, more and more becoming almost unimaginable. I mean, this is why, and I don't have any naive hopes for them, this is why I admire Syriza. My heart is breaking about how they are treated, because I know them personally. I met a couple of times Tsipras, Varoufakis, my God, we are friends, and so on. I can tell you this, forget about this media lies, Varoufakis, a crazy eccentric guy who walks around without a tie and makes provocations and so on and so on. read, try to get hold of what Varoufakis basically proposes to Brussels, to European Union. It's something, if you look at all his proposals, it's something so modest that literally what he's demanding from Brussels is 40, 50 years ago, this would have been an extremely centrist, modest social democracy. Much less than Sweden was doing at that point. Now, this is the first thing you should think about. Where are we when something that was part of the totally acceptable, normal social, mainstream social democracy? To do this today, you appear as a crazy, lunatic, radical leftist. No, there is another interesting thing, the topic of superego. Namely, you know, since I'm here also to speak in Freud House, we know Iberich, superego. Superego is something very interesting, you know. Superego, Freudian, it's not simply an ethical agency, but it's an obscene ethical agency. Freud described it nicely how the paradox of superego, Iberich, is that the more you follow it, the more you are guilty. You know, you are like your failure is part of the game in advance. And it's incredible to what extent this is confirmed. If you look at the statements by Varoufakis and others, they are not claiming, no, we Greeks don't want to pay the debt. No, they, my God, read them. Their language is extremely rational. They say, yes, we screwed it up. Yes. Their only criticism, or a couple of criticisms, are very rational. They claim first, listen, it's not Greeks as such. Which government is most responsible for the Greek debt? New democracy government. Okay, we had elections. Whom did Western Europe support? New democracy. Sorry, isn't this a little bit strange? That you have a fiasco, it's like, you know, fighting criminal and then supporting the main criminal. Second thing, not only the conditions, how this debt was acquired, but second thing, it's clear that, and here I would like to make you read, they are now popular, some of these post-Negri thinkers, Italian, like Franco Berardi or Maurizio Lazzarato. Lazzarato wrote a wonderful book called The Rise of the Indebted Man, where he has a wonderful, simple, but I think true theory of how in today's society, where you no longer can afford direct command, Herrschaft, domination, debt is the main way to control individuals and states. Because if you are indebted, you are controlled. You have to work for the debt and so on, to repay it and so on. And so the basic dialectic here is that it's absolutely clear that the question is not should the Greeks return the debt or not. I think that the secret ideal of those banks and countries who give debts is precisely that the debt should not be returned. That you have to be permanently in this controlled position, feeling guilty and so on. You know where I tested this empirically? Some 10 years ago, with the help from Chavez, who still had money at that point, I mean, Venezuela, Argentina surprisingly returned its debt to IMF. And I remember the official first reaction from IMF, which was, oh my God, what does it mean now? They will behave irresponsible. You know, they were really, literally shocked. They perceived as catastrophic news that Argentina returned, covered up the debt from them. So this is the next thing. What is so annoying for the West in Greece is that they admit their debt. This is even their reason. Varoufakis' reasoning is, listen, in 2008, we had 120 billions of debt. Now, after 7 years of your austerity politics, the country is almost ruined economically, but our debt is up to, as we all know, 180, 85 billions. So, obviously, your solution doesn't work, not even for you. It's not that they are destroying Greece to get the debt at least repaid. They are not getting it. They are still throwing money. So Varoufakis extremely modestly is proposing them, let's make an arrangement, like give us a little break here so that productivity raises, so that we can at least pay you some debt back. And it's, I think, irrationality is on the side of Europe here. You know how you can detect this? That even, for example, when Varoufakis visited Cameron and Osborne, the two conservative central figures of British government, they had great sympathy for Syriza. You know where I heard great sympathy for Syriza when I was in the United States recently? I always like right-wing TV. I listened to Fox News. There was a round table there practically pro-Syriza. So you should always be aware that what is happening now here, it's not at all about rational Europe encountering a crazy country who just wants to spend and so on and so on. No, it's a lesson of control. It's an ideological phenomenon and so on and so on and so on and so on. My next point, so let's go further. Another, and then maybe I can stop so that we don't go too far or how. Just one point I would love to make. Namely, the point about, the point about structure of power. How is power, how, this is I think an extremely interesting phenomenon. Namely, how does authority function today? Because I think this is part of this democratic game of, you know, we are all self-entrepreneurs and so on. Here I refer to the work of Alenka Zupančič and some other of my Lacanian colleagues in Slovenia. Traditional power works in a fetishist way, in the sense of you may know personally that that guy who embodies power is an idiot like you, but if he has the proper insignia, then when he speaks power, the law speaks through him. It's this fetishist logic of what in psychoanalysis we call symbolic castration. Like, for example, Socrates, when he was condemned to death, no? His point is basically, I know those judges who condemned me are idiots, but nonetheless, they are legal power. Law speaks through them. So it's this, je sais bien, mais quand même. I know very well, but. I know very well you are an idiot like me, but nonetheless, through you, a higher authority acts. So, okay, what I claim is that today, and this is maybe the big result of 68, 60s rebellion, and how this rebellion was reappropriated in a triumphant way by ruling ideology. Today, costumes, masks, this insignia of power, are no longer necessary. Today, power, I'll put it in this way. How does a typical, not all of them, of course, boss act today? It's no longer insisting on this dignity and so on. It's more like, listen, I'm the same guy like you, let's be equal. You know, a typical boss today, I don't know, you come on Monday to the job, he kicks you, did you have a good sex, a nice, or you know, like, we are the colleagues displaying the same weaknesses as you, but the paradox is all this not only in no way undermines his or her power, it makes it even stronger. The paradox is that the boss, the leader, authority, whatever, is allowed, as we say in psychoanalytic jargon, to display his castration, make fun of himself, ridiculous guy, weak, and so on and so on. And this in no way limits his power, but makes it in a way even more absolute. In what sense? Because I claim that when you have this egalitarian boss, the oppression is even worse. Because it's not so much that there is no Herrschaft domination, but that domination itself becomes unspeakable. What do I mean by this? Once I had a debate with Judith Butler, who I think was here a couple of times in Vienna, you know her, and we have many, I had many polemics with her, but at one point I agree with her, where she said that the most dangerous oppression, I simplify her argument, on women is not when they are directly oppressed, but when they are de facto oppressed, but this is masked by a superficial, oh, but we are the same, you know, like false spirit of fraternal equality and so on and so on. So she had a wonderful proposal. She said that in such a situation, the most subversive gesture of a woman is to demand men to act as a master. Like, you are de facto master, so don't give me this bullshit that we are all equal. Give me orders, and this is the way to maybe to undermine domination. In what way? Let me return to the beginning, to our beloved Stalinism. An example that I always like to use, a fictional example. Let's say we are in Moscow, 1935. Let's say, to be modest, you are a Central Committee, I am Stalin. Somebody has to be. I give a big speech, you applaud, you know, you applaud, I applaud, and so on. Then we have a debate. One of you attacks me. Next day, probably the big debate will be who has seen that guy alive the last month. But, now that's not all. Let's say then that another of you stands up and starts to shout at this first guy who attacked me. Are you crazy? We don't do this here. We don't attack Comrade Stalin. I claim the second guy would disappear even faster. You see the point? It wasn't only prohibited to criticize Stalin. It was even more prohibited to publicly announce this prohibition. It's not only that Stalin was a master, but if you say this, you were, well, you disappeared or whatever. So this paradox I find so fascinating. And here we learn so much about how ideology works, about how, we have relations of domination, but precisely the worst domination is a domination which, in which you, if you are the dominated one, you have to pretend as if, act as if there is no domination. I could go on here. There are many paradoxes here, which are not abstract theoretical paradoxes, but determine our daily life. Like, one of the basic ideological mechanisms, and this tells a lot about the freedom of choice, is that, to put it brutally, you are given the freedom of choice on one condition, that you make the right choice, you know? And now you will say, this is crazy. No, I think this is maybe even the fundamental feature of our symbolic universe, in a way. Look, don't you have these rituals? I repeat now some of my old topics. Don't you have these rituals? For example, let's say you are rich, I am poor. You invite me to dinner. And although we all know in advance that you will pay, but there is, at least in my country, I think, a ritual that I have when the bill arrives, I have to insist a little bit, no, 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 let me pay, and then we play this game for, I mean, if you really hate me, you should say, okay, pay. No, then. But you see, but it's too easy to say that this is a hypocrisy. This is how politeness works. And at this level, ideology at its most elementary enters. I hope you don't know it. There is a story which was told to me by a friend of mine when he served military service, when he did his military service decades ago in old Yugoslavia. I don't know how it is in your army, but now you don't know. When you still had conscript army, with Yugoslavia, it was like this, probably most of the armies. Once you are there, in the army. For some 2 weeks, you have elementary training, and there the big moment arrives, where all of you are gathered there. You repeat the pledge, I am red, blah, blah, and then you sign your name in some book, and you are a soldier now. Okay. What a friend of mine, this friend of mine was just there, saw this, did is something ingenious. After this ceremony, when he had to sign the book, he approached the officer and said, I don't want to sign it. And the officer told him, are you crazy? You will be arrested. Then the friend of my friend told him, but wait a minute, are you ordering me to sign it, or is this a free pledge? Officer told him, of course it's free. Free decision. Then the guy said, but if it's free, why should I sign it then, and so on. So they got engaged in a paradox, and at the end, the friend of my friend got a paper, I have a photocopy, where this officer gave him a written statement claiming that he, the officer, is ordering him, the soldier, is ordering him to freely sign the oath. I think, again, you have this mechanism at the very beginning, and I think we should do all these studies today if you want to get at how we are controlled today. For example, another story that I repeated 10, 20 times of how this permissivity can be even worse oppression. Imagine that you are a small boy, it's Sunday afternoon, your father wants you to visit your grandmother, and you hate it, of course. You would prefer to play with friends. If you have a traditional patriarchal father, everything is okay. No, the father will simply tell you, listen, I don't care how you feel, it's your duty to do it, do it, and behave properly. If this happens, everything is okay. You will rebel, you will become a normal young guy, okay. But now enters the monster called postmodern permissive father. What does he do? He does something like this. I know because I experienced this. He tells you, you are free to go or not, but please be aware of how much your grandmother loves you and misses you and so on. So you know what he is really telling you? He's subtly not just ordering you to go, but he's ordering you to go voluntarily, to freely go. You know, this is the true terror. Not just you have to do it, but you have to want to do it. And I think, again, mechanisms like that are absolutely crucial today. This is what, I'm sorry, we don't have more time to go into this, because this is, I think, so fundamental. That's why, if there is an era that I remember as a pure paradise, it was my military service. No, I'm not crazy. No, precisely, I was shocked, disappointed. In my psychological structure, I'm kind of a fascist, probably. I like discipline and order. And what shocked me in the army was how, it's not really like that, at least Yugoslav army. Beneath the discipline and order, there is an obscure domain of obscene jokes, perversions, and so on. And it took me a long time to guess how. There is nothing subversive in these jokes. They are absolutely crucial for the military discipline to reproduce itself. You know, and then more and more I'm convinced that every institution has something like this. For example, in the United States, the top colleges, you know, you have all these fraternities, sororities with their obscene rituals and so on. In Yugoslav military, another thing fascinated me. This is what my gay friends don't like to hear. Officially, publicly, the army was extremely brutally homophobic. And it really meant it. If a soldier was discovered to be gay, he was every night, nobody there to talk to him. He was usually every night beaten. You know, this standard ritual. Somebody puts a pillow on your head and others beat you with their belts and so on. Okay, you will say, okay, it's not so simple. Because at the same time, the entire army life was penetrated by homosexual innuendos and so on. I remember, for example, in my unit, when you met your friend in the morning. You didn't say good morning. You say smoke mine. This was an euphemism for fellatio, you know. Like it was every, I could give you dozens of it. So you know what fascinates me so much? That no power structure can reproduce its, you need what I call inherent transgression. Apparent dirty transgressions, which may appear even subversive, but they are part of the game. They are crucial for the reproduction of power structure. So why is this so important today? Because I think that today the official public structure is more and more egalitarian. Yes, but relations of domination survive at this implicit, obscene, unspoken level. You know, this secret, like, when do you really admit something? When do you really belong to a community, from the nation to a family? It's not enough just to follow the explicit rules. It's also to know how and when to violate these rules. I think a community is never defined, any communal body, just by the explicit rules. You not only this is why people who, to learn manners, go, but nobody cares about it today. You know, when I was still young, you had this people who taught you good manners so that you know how to behave in high-class society, and it always fails. Why? Because they taught you the rules, but they didn't teach you how to violate the rules. You are really a member of a community if you know all these implicit rules of which rules are you to take seriously, which rules you have to violate, how. For example, there are rules which are meant to be transgressed, especially in sexuality. When, for example, in traditional patriarchal sexuality, when father tells you not to mix with girls, it's really a call, do it discreetly, and so on and so on. There are many rules like this, which just, you know, this is the St. Paul Bible dimension of you need prohibition to generate your desire and so on. But much more interesting for me is the opposite example. Not when something is prohibited, but the message of the law is to do it, but when something you are permitted, even solicited to do it, you know, that you are given a freedom on condition that you don't use it. So if I may conclude with a story from my youth, I wasn't a big dissident. I was kind of a half dissident. And I remember when I was young, I was in a student journal, and there were elections. Now, in ex-Yugoslavia, elections were not as bad as in Soviet Union. The party didn't get 99.7. They had enough about 80, 85%. But we knew it, no? How it would. So we at the journal asked ourselves, what should we do? Some radical idiots proposed, why don't we simply openly do a heroic gesture? Let's publish an issue of this journal where we claim these were not free elections, these were a fake, and so on. Okay, we said, but everybody knows this. What would be the point? We would just appear idiots, you know. So then one of us, not me, had an ingenious idea which worked. We said, they are claiming that these are real democratic elections. So let's just treat them like that. And on the evening of elections, we published an extraordinary issue of the journal with big titles, latest election results. It looks that communists will remain in power, you know, like. And it was such a wonderful act because they were so furious at us, at the Central Committee. Not really, we didn't reach being correct. And they called us there and said, boys, don't do this, you provoke us. Then we just naively said, listen, these were free elections and we felt the duty to inform people of the result. And it was so tragic, this party bureaucrat, because he couldn't have told us, no, they were not free elections. He just said, boys, don't fuck with me. You know very well what I mean. We asked him, but what do you mean? Don't mess with me. You know, like, I almost felt the sympathy for that guy. You know, and now to really finish, because you once, when we had the last debate, asked me, where am I? Revolution, social democracy, whatever. Ah, I combine the two. No, not in some stupid synthetic way. That's why I like Syriza. That's why I like, up to a point, it's so fashionable today to be against President Obama. He did some good things. Why? Take Obama and universal healthcare. It's nothing revolutionary. My God, most of the Western liberal state have still some kind of universal healthcare. But in America, in the United States, it's a traumatic point. You know what happened to Obama. He was dragged up to the Supreme Court and so on. So I think the art of politics today is to formulate a specific demand, which is a very modest one. Nobody can accuse you, you want Stalinism or whatever. Like Obama healthcare, it's something that Canada has. But in that concrete constellation, it is extremely traumatic. You trigger a whole process. So not big demands can often be meaningless, you know. I remember this from my communist youth in communist Yugoslavia in the last years when they allowed dissidents, up to a point, dissidents become a profession. These were wonderful times, you know. Communist Party financed, like there was a dissident congress, anti-communist in Paris, and the government, okay, you can go there, blah, blah, we finance you the trip. The catch was just what? Don't be too concrete, you know. Like, communism is worse than fascism. Ugh, they didn't care about that. But don't say, repeal that law here in our country, you know. Like, that's my lesson from those times, that the art is often not to make big radical demands. For example, take Greece today. They have a communist party, which is still a pretty strong one. Usually it gets between 5% and 10%. Now they lost. And it's the last big, as far as I know, Stalinist communist party. By Stalinist, I really mean Stalinist. They still reprint the collected works of Stalin, which is their sacred literature. And even, for example, their enemy is not Gorbachev. Their enemy is Khrushchev, who betrayed it by And they said, no, Syriza is social democratic. No, let's wait. We want authentic revolution. And to be cynical, all right-wingers love them, because they know that it's totally meaningless. They don't threaten anyone. Nothing changes. It's just a very comfortable position of sitting there in the back with your radical demands and so on and so on. You know, that's the tragedy. If you say we want communist revolution, it means nothing. If you just say like Varoufakis, let's renegotiate debts a little bit, everyone is in a panic. And that's what we should learn. And here we should be very specific to specific countries. For example, in United States, universal healthcare triggers a process which you never know where it will end. In our countries, multiculturalism is a manipulated phrase. In Turkey, it means something, with Armenians, Kurds, and so on and so on. Here I see an option, you know, because what I love movies, so.
But we are very prominent members of this community. We broke all the disciplines, rules, and everything, especially beginning with the time rule.
You see, now I understand how was in Poland. You're like Jaruzelski now.
Of course.
Sorry, I stop. Yeah.
However, okay. As for Jaruzelski, this was this part of the communist regime that already started to look in certain dimension as what you hate in capitalism, which is this cynical,
I didn't have time, I totally agree. No, I will not talk again. But just to confirm me, that's crucial how cynicism works today. I claim it's not only that ideology works, even if you don't take it seriously. Exactly. I'm ready to go a step further. It has to be not taken not seriously to work. We have this, and again, I know this from my youth in Yugoslavia. I know two friends who worked at the Central Committee in the 70s. They lost their job. One of them is Ivan Hvala. The other is my friend. Why? Because they took self-management system seriously. They really believed in the system. And for nomenclatura, this was a horror. This was the first step towards dissidence.
This was exactly my point. The biggest fear for the late communists were the people who will really believe still in Marxism.
Yeah.
And immediately they expelled them from party, or like at least they isolated them somehow. I actually, you know, there were so many questions asked to you, but I realized that maybe one is, or never, or rarely, I don't believe that there is any question not already asked, but one cannot...
and not already answered, yeah.
But actually, I collected all the examples of those paradoxes that you... that you invented, that you mentioned, like the one with Syriza, the one with Fox News that actually is like a big fan
no,
of.
I couldn't believe it.
Syriza. But I think if you would like.
Can I just very briefly explain to you, and you will immediately understand me. Very reasonably, the point was what really made them afraid, Fox, right wingers, was, but in this way, we are pushing Greeks to Putin.
No, actually, this is the problem is that actually you can explain all those paradoxes pretty easily, giving the small answers, which, and the only disadvantage of the small answers is that they're not really spectacular.
So, like, give me an example.
I can actually answer to almost all of your paradoxes, like why the Western powers prefer new democracy, so the people who are responsible than Syriza, because they think that Syriza is an even bigger danger.
Why?
Okay, but this is another discussion, if they're right
or not. Why?
But they are
Syriza, extremely moderate social democracy.
For you, but not for the people.
Why? Why?
Okay, I'm telling you what's...
No, it's not for me. It's not for me. It's by Western European standards of 40 years ago. It's extremely modest social democracy. Really modest. Like, they even now, to give you the last proof, the latest news I have, they're not a priori against privatization.
Actually, I'm not. It's the discussion about Syriza, an agenda of Syriza.
Yeah.
This is one thing, but there is nothing paradoxical, actually, in the behavior of Western powers if, in the ranking of the dangers, Syriza is in a higher position than the previous powers responsible. So actually, I don't see any. I also don't see anything really paradoxical in why Fox News is like a big fan of the left-wing or even Putin. Actually, because behind this stays very coherent and exactly the same reason that they are anti-Americanists themselves. So anybody who actually is puts any pressure on the United States or can harm in any sense the Western alliance or whatever will be appreciated, because enemy of my enemy is my friend, which is like very coherent logic. I mean, at least from the pragmatic point of view. So, and also you said something which a lot of those paradoxes are based on the very Foucaultian point that like this, you know, discipline and punishment. You said that, so you said that like about this, like the behavior in the capitalist countries or like this, the debt man. I totally agree. This is exactly what happens. All my friends that are indebted, they will be a hostage of the mainstream. They will always vote for the ruling party, and like, and it's even if they totally know that they are doing the thing against themselves. Actually, this is something new in this late capitalism.
Yeah.
The fact that we know that we're doing something bad to us or generally, and we do it still. This is, I mean, solving this question, how to overcome it, would be probably the solving the question of
but
the left generally.
But you didn't convince me, but let's go back.
Okay, Foucaultian point would be easy. Yeah. I will answer you with a question. Like, if you really prefer the previous solution than the control or the discipline, it's like to asking Foucault what he really prefers, torture of the state with the king, or control with the which is the advanced model of like economy, society, or whatever. Are you really sure that you're gonna choose the previous version of it without the control of capitalist country, without the cynicism, without all those things that are?
This
like
is a complex question, because I am one of the few madmen whom I know who is still for death penalty. But this is another topic. No, I think that now you are too abstract in opposing in it. First, when you say torture, no? My God, it's today that torture is re-legalized. You don't have to look into some dark past. This is another fine point of ethical regression that I want. Are you afraid that the way even those who oppose torture, the way we in the liberal West are talking about torture today, is something that if you were to talk like this 30 years ago, you would be considered a totalitarian madman. You know what I mean? That even those who reject torture already accept it as a topic of debate and argumentation. Like they say, but it's not really efficient, you cannot rely on. No, I'm here for total dogmatism. I think we should rehabilitate dogma. Progress of humanity is the more good dogmas you have, all the better. So that you will not think that I'm crazy, let me give you another example, rape. Sorry, I wouldn't like to live in a society where you would have to argue all the time, you know, women really don't like to be raped or whatever. I would like to live in a society where you don't argue about this. Where if somebody starts with this bullshit, you know, but women really secretly enjoy it, he simply appears as a miserable idiot. Again, it's easy to agree with this on rape. I would say the same about torture.
But actually, it's like what the difference between one step of feminism and the second one. Mm. First, you have to show the difference, then to like overcome it and to forget it in an active way. So like, so this is why you have to like open the question of rape, exactly to close it and then to put it as a part of consensus, which is behind the discussion. But I don't see anything paradoxical. Actually, I also don't see anything paradoxical in this like Saudi Arabia example. Saudi Arabia is supported by the Western powers because this is the one of the very not too many solutions to control the region. Like Libya, for example, is something which might be a big problem for your like order of or line of thought. Libya actually is a country that was defeated like a dictatorship and created much more horrible problem exactly for the people to.
It's not only Libya. Afghanistan is the same.
Exactly.
Iraq is the same.
Seriously
claim that with regard to the position of women, Iraq now is worse than under Saddam, and I have no sympathy for Saddam. But whatever you say about Saddam. His regime was basically a secular regime with pretty important posts for women, education of women, in his good years before he, and that's the problem with dictators, before he went crazy.
But actually, these are the not easy questions. Like, would you really like to, like, I don't know, invade Saudi Arabia or like cut Saudi Arabia from any cooperation with Western powers? And what you get is for 80% the total mess in the internal war, which, as any civil war in Islam countries, is totally bloody. The biggest victim of Islamism are Islamists.
Islam themselves, of course. I see your point, and I'm here very, very pragmatic. I'm not a naive idiot who claims, you know, just give them democratic freedom and so on and so on. I'm just saying that, and this is not even a very original point. If you already return to this, the original scene is the end of World War I, when you had Lawrence of Arabia and all that bullshit. Let's not idealize it. But you have a kind of a genuine movement among Arabs, and then I think that this, not even United States, it was mostly England and France, when they cut it with this, all states that we have now there are totally artificial. Afghanistan is artificial state, Pakistan is artificial state, and so on and so on. So all I'm saying is that the first thing to, I'm not proposing any easy solution, but if you ask me these two cases, Saddam and Gaddafi, please, they were disgusting, and I know horrors, my friends told me, who were there as journalists. But I think it would have been much wiser. Now I will be cynical, and I will say, especially from the Western interest, not to overthrow Saddam and Gaddafi. Look at Saddam. Listen. That's why United States practically supported Saddam. I think, if you ask me, step further. The original scene of the West is then
Slavoj Žižek or someone else would challenge this, or like actually would say why West doesn't like invade Iraq or Saudi Arabia, if there is like, and so on. So like, actually...
No, I agree. This is a very complex topic. I agree. I agree. There are no easy solutions.
Okay, so I understand that we should... absolutely, absolutely. So,
but what I'm saying is that, okay, let me put it like this, sorry. They're making the wrong invasions.
Okay.
Why? You know what I mean? They are as if they have an incredible instinct to make... the big fear of United States is Iran. They invaded Iraq. What's the result of this? That the main political force in today's Iraq is Iran, who controls the Shia and so on and so on. It's just breathtaking. And if you ask me, I'm pretty much a pessimist here. I think we live in a complex world where whatever you do is in a way wrong. But my counter argument to what you said about Greece and so on, I'm not talking about justice here. I think that what Western Europe is doing now with Greece will be in the long term catastrophe for European Union itself. That's my very simple prediction. Okay. It will cut Europe into two, who knows what will happen. I think, or put it in this way, as an old dogmatic Marxist. You know, people say, we think we are a democracy, but there is some secret ruling class. I hope there would be, there is not. European rule political elite is more and more losing its ability to govern. And it worries.
Now, even if I don't have, I should say, Klaus saved you from more of my questions. and let me collect how many I can negotiate with the organizers. Two,
negotiate
three
with
questions.
Yourself. Yeah.
Three questions are okay. So we have one okay, so let's go one after answer after the question.
But we'll do it the Hegelian way. One divides into two, and then you have synthesis. Sie können auf Deutsch
sprechen. Yes, ich kann auf Deutsch auch sprechen, but also I can speak in English, because I think there's a few people who maybe not understand German. First of all, Slavo SCJ, thank you very much for giving us such an insight and vivid inside view in the boiling mind of an international reputed philosophical pop star. And yeah. Let me please only add, because what you did was such a row and such a machine gun fire of arguments, of memories, yeah. Of memories of what you read, of acquaintances, of people you told us you know and you met or whatever. So let me just add politely two things.
But
first of all, when you talked, when you talked about Boko Haram and ISIS, you could also have mentioned Opus Dei or maybe even the Vatican.
No problem.
No problem, of course. Secondly, this was such a cocktail, such a wonderful cocktail.
Mm. But a cocktail, I got
yes,
the point.
Cocktail,
yes,
a cocktail, and let me say it politely, a cocktail of platitudes from my point of view. And this was not easy to stand. It was somehow, I really felt a little bit knocked out, but I want to stay you very much, and I want to finish in a few words of okay. Slovenakin, Kvala Lepa, and Shivelitito. Thank you very much.
And?
Shivelitito!
Because now we come to the point.
Yes, of course.
Here,
I give you the argument. Of course, I know what I'm doing.
Here
yes,
I
yes,
disagree. You know,
least.
We have a big debate in Slovenia from nostalgics and so on. What was the war, the civil war, in the early 90s? I think it was not, because we betrayed Tito. I think all that was wrong, corrupted in Tito's Yugoslavia exploded there. I think that the war of the early 90s was that the ultimate cause was not even nationalism. It was the, very simplified, the... although I'm interested, could you elaborate that one? Sorry, so for me it was the survival of communist nomenclatura. This was the genius of Milosevic. He resuscitated nationalism, and in this way he legitimized the rule of old communist nomenclatura. But I wanted to ask you something else. Usually people say I have crazy, paradoxical, and so on. So let's go through. If what I said about, let's say what I said about how power functions today and so on and so on. If this is a platitude, in what sense platitude? That everybody knows it. I don't think everybody knows it. This permissivity and so on. I don't think everybody knows it. How is it with democracy?
Let me add one point. I do not understand. You're talking on freedom and everything. But, and you mentioned Marcuse, but please, please, politely, let me recommend you to you, before you again speak on freedom, reread only one book. And this is Marcuse's One-Dimensional Man.
A book to which I'm totally opposed. Because I think it's a totally wrong diagnosis. No, sorry. Right. No, no, okay. Wait a minute. I think that precisely Marcuse's One-Dimensional Man, you know where it misses the point? It is, I know the book. This was the book of my youth. It accept as a fact that capitalism will succeed basically as this new one-dimensional society and so on and so on. I think he didn't see antagonisms of capitalism and so on and so on, not to mention the fact. First, I think that as an analysis, socioeconomic is wrong, but especially, and every philosopher will tell you this, for example, the model of cheapest wrong Marxist, pseudo-Marxist criticism. The chapter against ordinary language philosophy, Austin and so on. Nice. Making fun of it, this is how theory, we may be critical about late Wittgenstein and so on, but it's nonetheless, it was a tremendous revolution in philosophy, useful also for critique of ideology. Marcuse there, not to mention, you know what's for me, Marcuse wrong? Yeah. Or take his, for example. Now I will go even further in my platitudes, if you want. When I see Eros and Civilization, I claim, fuck it, maybe Goebbels was right, just in the wrong way. Maybe we should burn books. But just Goebbels had a good principle but didn't burn the right books. This book is so totally worthless, this Freudo-Marxist idea, you know, sexual freedom, all the differences disappear. No, hedonism is today in power. I think precisely topics which, that's the horror of the 60s, that all the big messages of the 60s, sexual liberation and so on, were integrated into the ruling system. And I'm ready to go to the end here. Today we should make hard work, discipline. That should be our mottos today. I agree with this. Let's go to another question. Marcuse wrote one good book, Vernunft und Revolution, before World War.
Okay. I mean, it's easy. I think it's easy case to criticize Marcuse and a bit waste of time. But is there any other question here on the audience? If not, then I will pose the last question, and then something which bothers me is how you, by yourself, of course, considering also some of your arguments, distinguish between the radicalism, which is very useful to satirize the left-wing positions, and the radicalism which is efficient politically.
Show me one radicalism. No, I am for it, but what do you mean?
It's actually, there are too many examples of left-wing intellectuals or circles, movements, whatever, that are very useful for the mainstream to satirize the left at all. Because I don't think that, do you really need a reason or do you need an example?
You mean this.
How to distinguish between political radicalism and anti-political radicalism, to put it this way?
I just cannot locate the terms here. I am for radicalism. I'm just saying that sometimes to be truly radical is to insist on a tiny small point which may appear nothing, but if you press on that point, you trigger a process. But you know what's the problem? Maybe I should conclude with this, really. You know, what I hate, although sometimes we have to use this term, I hate the left which tries to reinvent itself as democratic socialism, like PDS and so on. I'm neither a Democrat nor a socialist. Why? First, socialism. I hate the term. Why? Because it's just, it means today just, no, we are not the bad communist totalitarians and so on. Socialism is something that everyone is ready to accept. Your compatriot, Otto Weininger, put it nicely, and of course I turned it around when he said, socialism is Aryan, communism is Jewish. Yes, I'm for communism. In other words, socialism is just a general motto for we shouldn't be too egotist, we should think about... Everybody can be a socialist. It's meaningless. I'm for communism. Of course, not for the 20th century, but whatever. Second thing, democracy. I don't despise it. It has its mega authentic moments. But nonetheless, I think that literally, quite literally, democracy is our fetish. Fetish in the sense that, strict Freudian sense, you know, Freud says fetish is the last object you see before you see that woman has no penis, whatever. So in what sense does this work? This castration, woman, no penis, would be vaguely a social antagonism. And I think the democracy functions how here? The model are two American films that I really hate, and I would put them on that Goebbels list to be burned. All the President's Men and Pelican Brief. They appear very critical. Hollywood left. Oh my God, the whole American state is corrupted, you know, and even the president is corrupted. Why then, when you finish watching that film, do you feel so good? Because the message is, but nonetheless, look, now I'm talking about all the President's Men. We live in such a great society that, you see, two ordinary guys, journalists, can overthrow the mightiest man in the world. Isn't this a great country? You know, this is democracy as a fetish. It's, yeah, antagonisms, but we have democracy, we can be calm, and so on, and so on. No, I think that democracy should be saved, of course, but it's a problem today. Everybody knows who is honest that in order to confront what we are facing today, new forms of racism, new forms of apartheid, ecology, biogenetics, whatever, the existing form of democracy is not strong enough. That's all I'm saying. And I'm here a radical pessimist. I'm not definitely not saying back to a Leninist party. I'm well aware that it was much worse. I'm just saying that, well, again, we don't even have mechanisms to cope with this. Just imagine, I recently spoke with a friend of mine from Japan who told me it's now becoming public that, do you know that in after that Fukushima explosion, for 2 days, three, but they didn't make it public. Japanese government thought that they will have to evacuate the entire Tokyo area. But imagine that you have to do something like this. Who will decide it? How? You know, this is why, incidentally, I am also absolutely opposed to this Negri topic, multitude, local self-organization of people, local democracy, and so on and so on. I'm totally for the rehabilitation of political representation. For me, this idea of, you know, locally people debating everything, deciding, first, it's not strong enough to confront our problems. To have an efficient local self-management democracy, you usually need a very efficient state, which provides all the background. Second thing, I don't think this is even now, to provoke you even more with another platitude, I don't think I would even like to do it. Look, let me look deep into my heart, if I have one, which I sometimes doubt. Would you really like to live in some shitty local community where you have to be active all the time, debate how we organize. No, I want to live in a well-organized society where some anonymous power does things and I can sit and watch movies and write my stupid books. I don't want to be permanently engaged and so on. I hate the very idea of this, you know, people meeting, how will we... I want water in my pipe, I don't care how they distribute it and so on. You know, but I'm serious here. You know to what this brings us?
So the world without alienation would be a disaster.
Absolutely, literally. I think one, and here I even agree with my friend, although right-winger, but we can learn from conservative, intelligent right-wingers, Peter Sloterdijk, who said the problem today is we don't have enough alienation. We have to, we should break this politically correct multicultural stupidity. We have to understand the other. No, how can we understand the others when they don't understand themselves, when we don't understand ourselves? Let's say I live in a building where there are some Persians, some Arabs, some blacks, some Latinos, whatever you want, some Chinese. I don't want to understand them. I want to live a respectable life where we respect each other, friendly, say hello. And I absolutely, not because they are what they are, maybe I can become friendly with some of them, probably more preferable than friendly from my own nation. No? But what I'm saying is that, you know, this idea of just understanding, coming together, I think that quite, you know what is for me the basic, the beauty of alienation? Politeness. Politeness is all about alienation. What is politeness? Sorry to use my old example. Politeness is I meet you on the street, and this is not real you, but maybe. Let's say for what reason I hate you, but I don't. And I meet you. And of course, before I notice you, I start to curse. Why didn't I notice you 3 seconds before so that I could cross the... And, but then when I see you, we have to say, hello, nice to see you, how are you? Now, listen to the paradox. We both know that I don't think that it was nice to see you and that I don't give a shit about how are you. But nonetheless, it's politeness. It's, in a way, a sincere lie. The message is much more refined. The message is not, I am lying. But the message is, even if I am now in a bad mood and don't care about you, nonetheless, there is a certain fundamental acceptance, benevolence, and so on and so on. It would be, in other words, politeness in the sense of this basic alienation of language that you don't say what you mean. It gives you the breathing space, my God. And here, I think, with the help of Freud and Lacan, we should correct Marx. I think that the whole topic of literally, we need more alienation. Why this hermeneutically imperialist approach, we should understand them, we should understand them. My second dogma here is the only practical understanding that works is struggle. Not with the enemy, but solidarity in struggle. I hate another candidate for that Goebbels book burning. You know, those, they were popular when I was young, those UNESCO books describing all the world cultures, you know, how beautiful this, that culture, that's disgusting. My point is that we in our culture have our own conflicts, antagonisms. They have their own conflicts. The only authentic universality is the universality of struggle. To discover that our struggle is part of the same struggle as their struggle. That was for me, with all the illusions, for example, the magic moment of, with all the illusions, I know, Tahrir Square in Egypt. All of a sudden, it wasn't important. Are they Muslims? Do we mean the same things? It was an instant universal solidarity, and I don't think it was an illusion. You see, this is what I believe. In India, I immediately connected with them. Why? Because I hate their post-colonial cultural studies, which is for me just basically half Indian racism and so on. But I discovered that the majority of my friends have exactly the same attitude. My friends there are Naxalite, Maoist guerrillas. My friends are the untouchables and so on. My friends are those who got the point that the only chance for India was accepting English language. That English language, precisely because it was of, this is what the truly intelligent post-colonialists know there, that English language, precisely because it's externally imposed, was able to function as a media for United India, and so on and so on. You see, struggles, it immediately works. I was in Japan, I was in China. As long as we do this general exchange of what do you mean by this, that, blah, blah, you can endlessly debate. The moment there is the fight, that guy was arrested, oppression here, there, you have universality.
Thank you very much.
And now Comrade Stalin will conclude.
Now you're free to do whatever you want as long as you go down and have a
wine. Now you're repeating my formula. They're free to do whatever
Absolutely.
They want as long as they do.
Exactly. You can freely choose downstairs where you are very welcome. Thank you very much, Slavoj.
Wow.
Think of this performance from Leibach's greatest fan.
Yeah, did he bring up Leibach this time?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, no, he always brings up some kind of music. I don't know. I'm sure he brought up the Second World War as he usually does. Mm. I don't know. I find him to be one of the few voices who's constantly slapping the NPR left in the U.S. always a bit refreshing.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I feel like there's a whole industry. I mean, maybe we just listen to different podcasts or something like that. I feel like
That's
there's
true.
An entire industry of slapping the NPR left. Like, do you ever listen to Doug Henwood?
No, no.
Oh, he's great.
Yeah. Well, there's that show, the late night one, like the something show. I forget. Chris Carlton's a big fan.
Chapo Trap House?
Mm-mm.
Also
Mm-mm.
slaps the NPR left.
Okay. I got to update my my cue.
But no, I feel like there's like a point where... it's like the same thing as being like a living composer, mm-hmm. you know, where there's like, there can really be only one. Like most people know that there's Philip Glass.
Mm-hmm.
And regardless of how like crowd pleasing or whatever, like a work by like John Luther Adams is or something like that, you know, who's like a big deal.
That's for the connoisseurs.
Yeah. It's still something where like you have to have cared a little bit more, but like everyone knows that like Philip Glass is a living composer,
mm-hmm.
and everyone knows that like Slavoj Žižek is like an intellectual.
Yeah,
but then like once that role has been acquired for one, how does one actually do work as an intellect? Like the biggest problem with Žižek now is Žižek.
Yeah, yeah.
But like he can't.
Well, unlike Philip Glass, I think he confronts that to some degree. Like he's made himself into kind of a charlatan.
Right. He's like also he's a clown.
Yeah. But I think that he, like, you see this in art as well. Like when people's careers really pick up.
Yeah.
And sometimes they try to deal with that fact.
Uh-huh.
And most of the time they don't. They're just like, well, I'll keep making the ceramic that made me famous.
Right.
And I feel like his work has changed drastically since the 80s.
Žižek's.
Yeah. To absorb the fact that he's like the Elvis Presley of philosophy. And
yeah.
And so like he's constantly aware of that and uses that to, and instead of someone like Alain Badiou, who's also kind of well known.
Yeah.
Who, like,
kind of
shrinks,
a big deal. Yeah.
Kind of shrinks into like more proper thought, if you will.
Yeah.
Instead of Žižek's been like, okay, well, if I'm talking to the so-called public,
the people,
now, I'm just going to, emphasize the things that are legible at that level.
I think the funny thing about Žižek versus Badiou is also that like Badiou clearly has no personality. Like, I mean, I'm sure he has plenty of personality at home, you know, to his friends or whatever, but his presentation, and maybe also just his facility. Maybe like, I have never tried like a full francophone exposure to Badiou. Maybe like maybe he's freewheeling in French but just doesn't have the chops to do English, whereas like Žižek can totally rip in English as well.
Yeah, he's quite good at it. There's also, I think he's while he is a kind of talking head at this point, he does seem to do a good job of putting his real intellectual allegiances out there. Like, I know the last few years have just been like really long, serious tomes on Hegel, because he's like, well, right, I actually have the capacity to influence what thinkers are taught.
Yeah.
You know, because a lot of people will get into critical theory through me.
Yeah.
Like, I'll be like their introduction.
Yeah. They'll read the book about 9/11 or something.
Yeah. And then they'll be like, oh, you know, and they'll talk to, you know, people of the opposite gender or something in coffee shops about it. And that'll be really exciting. So then maybe those people will go on to like actually read Hegel or something like that.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
Hopefully. I mean, he's got a bunch of crappy books. We can be honest.
Who's going to read Hegel? Like, having recently read Hegel, do you feel like if you were invaded to read Hegel by, like, cast yourself back to an undergraduate time of life where your exposure to Zizek arguing with Jordan Peterson has convinced you to read a Zizek book and you read his new Hegel tome, do you think you would then feel competent reading Hegel?
I've never once felt competent reading Hegel.
That's exactly it, right? Like, it's like, I don't think there's such a thing as gateway drugs to Hegel.
Okay, well, but there are certainly blocks.
Yeah,
And you know, journalistic accounts of the meaning of jokes or something.
Right,
like that's probably not going to get me into Freud.
Yeah,
but I'm trying to think of what even got me into that stuff in the first place. Okay, so to be honest, like maybe someone who is like had a Zizek type role.
Yeah,
what got me into philosophy was reading fiction. Uh-huh. And I got really in just because of the covers of those Penguin Classics books.
Yeah.
Because I think they're handsome covers.
Yeah. Care went into that.
Yeah. And then, like, you know, if you're doing that, like, they had a Nietzsche one.
Yeah.
That Capital is bound in that volume. Mm-hmm. And so I was just like, well, I like the other stuff. Like, you know.
Yeah.
I like the other stuff these guys have done.
Penguin.
The classics, you know. I don't even know what they do outside of the classics. Or are they called? They call Penguin Classics, I think.
Yeah,
with
well,
the black bar at the bottom.
Yeah,
yeah.
And then previously it was the sort of puce border,
yeah,
with a black rectangle at the top.
Sure, and it always had like a romantic painting usually on the cover.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, like that was just some publisher making some decision about publishing these important works in cheap paperback form, and had like an influence on my life.
Huh? Yeah, I feel like secondhand bookstores where I actually, you know what was the big influence on my life was in this direction was books of general knowledge. Like there'd be like just like a book of like cocktail discussion topics.
Okay.
And it would be like, what are other countries like? What are the most important Western philosophers? Mm. What are different kinds of animals. What are, and I would just read as a child, I would just read books like that and be a pretty great child conversationalist.
Okay.
With adults, which is literally the only people I would have to talk to for the most
part. You didn't have siblings, right?
No, exactly. As an only child. And I lived in a neighborhood largely of senior citizens.
Okay.
So I could talk to old people and that worked out well. And I was like, oh, reading these general knowledge books are great. You know, so it's basically like sort of like condensed encyclopedias. And that's where...
And they were just meant to spark table conversation?
They were meant to sort of provide you with like an understanding of what was out there so that you wouldn't...
Oh, they gave the answers. They weren't just the questions.
Yeah, they would be like, Wittgenstein's like this.
Oh, okay, okay.
The main points that he makes are like this, and he makes them in this
special way. I
thought
it was like a book where it's like, you know, questions to ask at the cocktail party to get things going.
Oh, no. It was like just about like, oh, these are like a condensed history of music.
Okay.
A condensed history of philosophy.
All
of them would just be like sort of smashed together in one big condensed.
How did they come across your desk as a young lad?
I think people just gave you these kind of books as a kid. You know, like, you know, along with like an atlas and like.
He seems precocious.
You know, a book about... You know, animals of Madagascar or something like that.
Because this sounds like a good gift, but as a child, I remember getting lots of gifts from like, you know, like extended family or neighbors, whatever. We were like, what on earth?
Yeah.
Because normally, like, it'd be like if, you know, like our friends do have kids.
Yeah.
And they're like turning five and you're like supposed to get them a gift. And you're like, well, I have not met a 5-year-old in a long time. So I'm going to give them probably an awkward gift.
Yeah.
Because I don't know.
What 5-year-olds are like.
Yeah. Apple gift card. You know?
Yeah, Apple gift card.
But then every once in a while you'd have like, this is usually like one of your friend's parents who obviously had a kid because you were friends with their kid. and they give you like an amazing gift. Like I remember getting this like how to draw an illustrative style, like different dinosaurs. Amazing. It was an amazing gift. I got good at drawing like this T-Rex and a large crocodile.
And all your friends were impressed.
Well, I was closest with this guy, Jonathan, and he already had the book. So.
Oh, so we already knew how to draw T-Rexes, or we like knew how you came by this information.
Yeah, he
wasn't
that
thing.
Impressed.
The point is to not show your hand.
Yeah, which is something Zizek talked about tonight. You know,
that's
that
true.
Which he does have these occasional moments of brilliance where the bit was about how a joke has no author.
Yeah.
Which I had never really reflected on. Like, you always begin a joke saying, like, I heard this joke, or I have this joke. It's never, like, the joke of...
Yeah. Now, my newest joke.
Yeah, or, this joke comes from 1876.
Yeah, right.
Originating in Shrewsbury, England.
Yeah, yeah.
By Sir Count Dukeville.
Yeah, right. Author of this joke.
Author of this joke. Now I begin. No, it's just, here erupts joke from void.
Yeah.
Which, you know, first Zizek is always the, every anecdote is an attempt just to understand how ideology works. So I guess ideology works similarly for him.
Yeah.
It has no author.
Well.
The Talking Show does have an author, and those authors are signing off because one of them has to hightail it back to Tejas.
Yeah. Wait, getting up early and getting on a plane to, getting on the 9 o'clock flight at LAX.
Oh, goodness.
Jesus Christ.
That's a little early.
Yeah.
Who booked that one, Steve?
Meredith.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm taking the cats.
Okay. Well, have fun with that. Good luck with the cats.
Yeah,
and
thank you.
We will see you next Wednesday, Steve.
Yes. Good night,
Good morning,
everyone.
Chinatown.